Hello, and welcome to Fraud Talk, the ACFE's monthly podcast. I'm Scott Patterson, Senior Public Relations Specialist for the ACFE, and this week is International Fraud Awareness Week. More than 700 organizations worldwide have signed up as official supporters of Fraud Week, and many of them are hosting trainings, engaging social media, communicating anti-fraud information, and finding other ways to increase fraud awareness. The ACFE provides resources for them to download and use during this campaign, and a lot of these materials include stats from our biannual fraud study, the Report to the Nations on Occupational Fraud and Abuse. So in recognition of Fraud Week, we've invited the co-authors of the Report to the Nations, John Warren and Andy McNeil, to talk about the report and how they collect and analyze these invaluable fraud statistics. They'll also give tips for any organization to help prevent fraud. John Warren is the ACFE's Vice President and General Counsel, and Andy McNeil is Director of Research for the organization. Welcome, John and Andy.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for having us.
John, can you tell us in a nutshell about the methodology used to create the Report to the Nations?
Sure. The way we gather the information for the Report to the Nation is we send out an electronic survey to all certified fraud examiners who are in good standing throughout the world. In 2012, that was roughly 34,000 members. And the survey asks them to give us information, detailed information, on one occupational fraud case that they've investigated. And there are a few criteria that they have to meet. It has to, obviously, first of all, it has to be a case of occupational fraud, which is basically insider fraud. It has to have occurred within the last 2 years. The investigation has to have been completed. So in the 2012 study, it had to have come January 2010 or later. They have to be reasonably sure that the perpetrator was identified in the investigation, and the investigation has to be complete. Once they meet those criteria, we ask them several questions. I believe it's 68 questions that are very detailed, getting into the mechanics of the scheme, the costs of the scheme. We want to learn information about the victim organizations. What type of victim were they? What size were they? Where were they located? We ask for information about the perpetrators of the frauds, and then information about the case results. Was the case prosecuted? Did the victim recover any of its losses, and so forth? Our members, and I want to make a point of this, our members take a lot of time in filling out this survey. It requires quite a bit of work to go back through their case files, recreate this, and provide all this information. And they do this on a volunteer basis just to basically further the advancement of knowledge about occupational fraud. So we're really grateful to the members who take part in the survey. In 2012, we got, out of the 34,000 members we surveyed, we got 1,338 usable responses of occupational fraud. And from those, and I should also mention that all of those responses are anonymous. We do not publish any information about the victim, the perpetrator, or even the CFE who reported the case. We're purely gathering data in order to conglomerate the data and then derive patterns or trends out of a group of cases. So we never report any information from one particular case or one single instance, anything that could identify anybody involved in a particular fraud. But in this case, as I said, we had 1,338 cases, and the data from those cases, the information from those frauds, is what goes into the 2012 report.
Okay, thanks, John. And so you get all these responses back, so many different surveys. Andy, how do you go about compiling this information? Where do you start?
We start by pooling all of the responses that we receive into a database, and perhaps the most mundane step, scrubbing all of that data to make sure it's usable, it's understandable, and it's really going to enhance our analysis. So anything from going in and making sure all the numbers are actually in numeric format to making sure that the narrative that is provided about the case matches the information they provided about the schemes when they were completing later questions in the survey, and just making sure that it's all comparable and analyzable in the database. From there, we begin our actual analysis, which is where, for me personally, it actually is kind of where the fun begins. We get to see what trends we can find in the data. We begin with sort of parsing out what the different schemes were that occurred, the proportions of those, how common things were, the different costs that the schemes caused, basic information about the perpetrators, their genders, their income levels, their age groups, what department they worked in, the information about the victim organizations in terms of the size of the organization or the industry that they belong to. There's just so much information that we receive that we actually have to start paring down what we're going to include in the final report, but we also are trying to identify new areas that we haven't explored before, and that's where it gets really interesting, I think, from a research perspective is, you know, we work in a group and kind of bounce ideas off of each other in terms of, hey, did you see this over in this section, and does it relate to anything that you're seeing over in your section, and from there we just work to see what trends we think are going to be the most interesting and helpful and educational for the readers of the report.
John, is that your experience as well in terms of putting it together?
It's about a six-month process for us to go through from the moment we release the survey until the report is actually ready to be printed. I'd also point out that we have a great in-house graphic design team that takes all these globs of information and text that we hand them and turn it into something that's pretty user-friendly, that somebody can open up the report, and even though there's a lot of complex data in there, they can look at it. And from the design of the charts, from the layout of the tables and so forth, pretty quickly glean information that's going to be useful to them. And a lot of credit goes to our graphic designers here at ACFE for that.
Yeah, it's definitely not that pretty when we hand it to them.
No, it's not.
They do a great job with it. Now, the report addresses occupational fraud. Andy, could you tell us what this means? Just give us a few examples, if you would.
Absolutely. When you think about the word fraud, it really, to a lot of people, means a lot of different things, and it's really broad. So to make our analysis as pertinent as we can, we really hone down into this area of occupational fraud, which to us means basically fraud that's committed by employees against the organizations they work for. So it's anything from employees skimming incoming cash receipts to a bookkeeper writing checks for him or herself, or somebody in the warehouse stealing inventory, or an employee taking bribes from a vendor, all the way on up to an executive who is falsifying the company financial statements. So what we're really going for here is the type of fraud that presents a universal risk to all organizations, any organization that has employees on staff, regardless of region or industry or size.
John, where did the idea for the report originate?
Well, the idea originally came from our founder, Dr. Joseph T. Wells. And this was something that came about in the mid-90s. We were a much smaller organization then, a much younger organization. And one of our missions, obviously, as an association of anti-fraud professionals, is to educate our members about the threats of different kinds of fraud. And we knew from experience and just anecdotally that occupational fraud, any kind of fraud where people are stealing money or falsifying financials of their organizations, that was a huge threat. I mean, we just understood that from experience. But when we started looking for ways to quantify that threat or to provide our members information about, you know, hard data about how it occurs or when it occurs or against whom it occurs, we found that there really was very little information out there, which was shocking to us. We thought, you know, this is a huge problem. Why isn't anybody studying this? Now, ACFE was never set up to be a research organization, and that was never a goal of ours. But at some point, Dr. Wells realized, I think this is kind of the genius of the report, is he realized we were sitting on this enormous pool of knowledge in the form of our members. You know, we had, I don't know how many thousands of members at the time, but many, if not most of them, spent their days investigating occupational fraud schemes, or at least had in the past. And he thought, well, if nobody else is studying this, we should. And so we sent, in probably 95, 96, we sent our first survey out to these members saying, just give us information on one case. And again, it was really, that sounds simple, but at the time it was hard. Fraud cases, by their nature, there's a lot of liability involved, there's a lot of sensitivity to them. And so it took a lot for our members to have trust in us to turn over this information. And obviously it helped that we don't ask them again to tell us who the victim was or any specifics. But the response was overwhelming. We got tons of cases, survey forms. At that point, you couldn't do it electronically, so it was all paper. But we got inundated with survey forms coming back, giving us information from all these cases. And so we took that and compiled that into their first report. And we just had an overwhelming response to it. It was a real problem for certified fraud examiners and anti-fraud professionals at the time, and it still is, to help management and clients understand what a risk fraud was. And it's really hard when you can't point to any numbers or any studies, when you just kind of have to ask them to take that on faith. And this was something where we could say, here's what it costs. You know, here's all these schemes. We looked at them, and it cost this, and this is how it happened. And we began to, for people who may be familiar with the fraud tree, we began to categorize the different types of cases, and that came out of their first report to the nation. So it was a really big step. And we thought at the time it was just going to be a one-off project, you know, a research project. Then we'd go back to our ordinary business of, you know, conducting training and certifying members and so forth. But 4 or 5, 6 years later, people were still quoting that report, and it was showing up in major media outlets, and it was showing up in academic research papers, and we were still getting requests for it, and we started getting requests for fresher data, because at that point, you know, it's getting kind of stale. We're 5 years in, and circumstances change and so forth. So in 2002, we made the decision to do a second study, and we did it much along the lines of the first one. And from that point on, we've done it every 2 years. It's a biannual study. And this 2012 report, I guess, if my math is right, will be the seventh right?
Yes.
So it's continued to grow. And each time we do one, we, as Andy said, we try to add a little bit of a new analysis, but we try and build on what we've learned in the past. And over the years, we've kind of developed this body of knowledge from all these different studies going back. You know, you're probably talking 7,000-8,000 cases of fraud over the years that have been represented in these studies. So it's been a huge thing for ACFE, and we continue to get really good feedback on it.
Wow. So you said the second edition was in 02, if
yes.
I heard correctly. When was the first one published? When was the inaugural edition?
The first one came out in 1996.
Oh, okay. And it was called The Report to the Nation?
Yeah, The Report to the Nation on Occupational Fraud and Abuse.
It's 1996. Wow. So the report has evolved over more than 15 years. I mentioned Fraud Week at the top of the show. I had to do a little digging in the ACFE archives to discover that the first Fraud Week was held 12 years ago in 2000. So back then, it was a national movement, hadn't yet gone global. Andy, knowing that the first report came out 4 years before that, what kinds of changes, if any, have we seen in the fraud landscape since then?
Well, in 1996, we were still pre-Enron, WorldCom, all the huge scandals that that we experienced in the early 2000s. And as absolutely terrible as those were, they certainly brought fraud to the common discussion of many Americans and many people throughout the world in ways that they really hadn't had before. So I think there's a definitely an increased level of awareness that we didn't have now that we didn't have back in 1996. But we also saw after those scandals, things like Sarbanes-Oxley and related legislation in other countries that required companies to start instituting very specific anti-fraud controls. And related, we saw industry regulations, SAS 99, and other auditing standards that really focused auditors on what their responsibilities were related to fraud. So I think there's been a big increase in not only public scrutiny, but in their expectations regarding what organizations are doing to prevent and detect fraud. We've also seen, obviously, huge technological advances since then. You know, computers back then were not the commonplace.
Couldn't put things in a database. You didn't have the ability to compile data, to extract data like you.
You're basically just getting paper surveys at
exactly.
that point. Yeah, but, and marking them down. Okay.
And then the same thing happened with fraud victims and anti-fraud investigators.
Exactly. So, you know, you think about. From our research perspective, that's a big deal. But from a fraud detection perspective, that's an even bigger deal. You know, there's technology out there now that can cull through mountains of data so much quicker than was possible back then. Technology also has increased possibilities for fraudsters in terms of how they commit and conceal their crimes. But, you know, it's a cat and mouse game where the technology advances aids the fraudsters in a certain way, but it also aids those that are trying to fight the fraudsters. So that's definitely changed the landscape. And then we've also, one other area that I think we've really seen some changes is just the sort of fall of international barriers to commerce. We see companies of ever decreasing size, smaller businesses reaching out into doing businesses in other countries. And with that, there's definitely additional fraud risks to those companies that they might not be so equipped to handle.
Now, we see the Report to the Nations quoted in the media just all over the place, really. The stats get a lot of media interest, and so do awareness efforts like Fraud Week. Why do you think people respond to this message about fraud and the risks and dangers of fraud so strongly?
It's probably related to how universal the risk of fraud is. Any organization anywhere really has the risk of succumbing to a fraud scheme, being defrauded by an employee or an outside party. But it's also somewhat understated, and a lot of companies don't think, you know, they think, hey, this can't happen to us. This isn't, you know, that's the next guy over. It's not our company. But when they see the findings in the Report to Nations, they see that it's happening in small businesses, that it's happening in their industry, that it's happening in nonprofits, that it's happening in their region. A lot of times we hear that, you know, that really speaks to them in a way that they hadn't seen before.
John, you actually take several of those media calls when they come in about the Report to the Nations. What do you find is the main interest in what they're calling about?
You know, I think what Andy said is right. I think people are, you know, people are just interested for whatever reason in stories of crime in general. And if you can add crime to accounting, I mean, how exciting is that, right? But I think Andy alluded to this before. Years ago, you know, pre-Enron, there wasn't much awareness of fraud. You know, and it was just sort of something that, you know, nobody talked much about. Nobody, auditors didn't really want to deal with, and companies didn't want to admit that they had fraud. There was a time where people didn't want to have the word fraud in their business title. They didn't want to be called a certified fraud examiner because they thought it implied that their company had fraud, and that was a really scary thing. And, you know, over the years, it's become a much more accepted idea that this is a risk that all companies have. And I think as that acceptance has grown and people have become more aware of it, there's just a curiosity about, well, how does this happen and how did it happen to this company? And so when, you know, when I get a call, it'll be about, you know, in some small town, somebody embezzled $4 million from a bank. Well, how did this happen? Does this happen? There's a lot of interest in why did it happen? You know, how did this person get away with it? Why were they able to? Why didn't somebody catch it? And, you know, I think that's just something that's a natural evolution out of the big fraud cases we've seen in the past, that people are finally aware that, you know, it is something that they need to be on guard against. And, you know, hopefully the report has had some impact in raising that awareness. But really, it's things like Bernie Madoff and Enron and WorldCom that raise that awareness. And it's a shame it takes that to make people aware of it and make companies aware of it. But I think we're at a place now where it's much more acceptable to talk about fraud and think about fraud and hopefully prepare for the eventuality of fraud within your company or agency.
Great. Well, thank you, John. And thank you, Andy, for giving us a real good inside look at the Report to the Nations. You've been listening to John Warren and Andy McNeil talk about the Report to the Nations and Fraud Week. The report itself can be downloaded from the ACFE website at acfe.com. And more information about International Fraud Awareness Week can be found at fraudweek.com. Again, my thanks to John and Andy for speaking with me today. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us in another edition of Fraud Talk. This has been part one of a two-part podcast. Join us tomorrow for the conclusion of our interview with John Warren and Andy McNeil.